Good afternoon. Let me begin by asking you if the recent weather has caught your attention. In fact, how many of you believe in the effects of global warming and climate change? Hands up. You know, that's impressive. You'll be impressed, Jeff. Well, to make you a believer is Dr. Jeffrey Dalbelko, Director of Environmental Studies at the Voinovich School of Leadership and Public Affairs at Ohio University. As a senior advisor as well at the Woodrow Wilson Center for Environmental Change and Security, he is eminently qualified and prepared to take us through the list of concerns that are proving challenging for our military leaders and homeland security as the effects of climate change start to impact world populations. Dr. Dalbelko received his AB in political science at Duke University and his PhD in government and politics from the University of Maryland. Father of three children, he divides his time between Columbus, Ohio, and Washington, D.C., and you might believe that he is welcoming the temperatures here in Naples with us. Please welcome Dr. Jeffrey Dalbelko.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm very pleased to be engaging with all of you. It's a complex topic. It's a multidimensional topic. We will adopt a 30,000-foot view to try to cover a lot of ground, and then I look forward to us delving deeper in the questions. I often would tell you a little bit at this point about this kind of two hats of a Washington, D.C., and spending a lot of time trying to bring the worlds of climate change and environment and health and development together with the worlds of foreign policy and security policy. And then could say a little bit about my time in Ohio and the kind of not splendid isolation of academia, but perhaps the real world of the United States as distinct from within the Beltway. But in fact, I want to tell you about the time that I really came to understand what we're up against, but also the opportunity to move forward together. And that was some years ago back. I was visiting the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. We were conducting a multi-day scenario game, role-playing scenario, war game, as they called it. We were collaborating with the War College and the professors there who were trying to also grapple with these emerging topics in the wake of the Cold War. It wasn't that they were new, but there was newly space to discuss them. And so literally, as I was driving onto the base, I had the head of a prominent non-governmental organization coming from that environment, health, and development side with me, and she whispered, "Jeff, we're going on to a military base." "Yes, Amy, we are." She says, "I'm not sure my family would be okay with that." You know, I was like, "Well, you know, you may have signed up for the wrong thing," but to give you a sense of folks who just don't have the opportunity to interact with that community and just assumes that the tools and the interests and the methods and the concerns that community has are not the same as hers. And then literally within the hour had the opportunity to talk to one of our prominent foreign policy experts, an ambassador who came out of the security community and expressed his trepidation about how it really was to spend, going to spend the 2 days with these tree huggers who were going to try to jam this environmental stuff down his throat, and he just wasn't prepared to buy it. Well, I'm here to tell you that after 2 days and walking in each other's shoes, literally, there was a recognition by both parties that there was an awful lot of commonality of the challenges that we were facing, that these were topics that were appropriate and needed to be discussed in a foreign and security policy context, that while the toolboxes each had and the concerns each had differences, there were also a lot of commonalities that were built around that. And that is the context in which we will talk today. Given our location, I promise not to preach at you, but to have a conversation to try to understand how these worlds are coming together. And we understand really the myriad challenges presented within a sense of complexity and uncertainty, but nevertheless requires us to take on these challenges. So, as I said, we need to abandon our stereotypes, right? The sense that if we're coming to this conversation on climate change or an environment, that the young man trying to hug the tree is but a caricature, that there are literally life and death issues associated with natural resources for us in the developed world and those certainly in the developing world that are so dependent on these resources for their livelihoods. And then also at the same time that the security community and the military is more than about just blowing things up and breaking things. And so on the face of it, it may seem those tools are mismatched to the challenge of climate change and addressing the implications for natural resources and economy and food and water. And in fact, it's, as I mentioned, that role-playing gaming scenario exercise is fundamental to how our security community challenge takes up these challenges and understands how we need to take action in the face of uncertainty or low probability, but nevertheless critical to take action now because waiting is too late. In the words of General Sullivan, on the battlefield, if he waited around for certainty of information in terms of that battlefield environment, bad things were going to happen. And so when he weighed in on climate change and what we needed to do, he saw waiting around for greater scientific certainty as just unacceptable because in the same way, bad things were going to happen. Any of you have the opportunity to see this film? It's about 10 years old now, called The Day After Tomorrow. Remarkable in that, for example, Dennis Quaid was somehow able to walk from Philadelphia to New Jersey overnight and such. But to the point here, the discussion was actually, as you can see, Statue of Liberty was quickly iced over in a matter of days and weeks. So a fairly fantastic vision of what was meant by climate change. Anybody have the opportunity to read this novel? I emphasize novel rather than reality. I'm sorry again for your time spent on that as well. The plot of this, which was the evil greeny activists were trying to make California fall into the ocean so the rest of us would then pay attention to the problem of climate change. And so the hero was foiling this attempt to knock off California. So we have two extremes, right? This discussion is unfortunately often framed by extreme versions. There's a whole lot in the middle for us to talk about, and that's what we'll do today in ways that come at it from this security frame. There are many additional frames to come at it, but come at it from this frame that allows us to dismiss the tails and focus on the substance in the middle, because there is an awful lot of substance in the middle. So how did these topics come together? Climate change on the one hand, set of scientific questions of what these impacts of increased concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere will have, and traditional foreign and security policy context. Well, for starters, the science caught the attention of the security community. The fact that what had been seen as incremental and slow and diffuse changes suddenly were becoming very rapid. It wasn't a convenient incremental set of changes. They were racing ahead and thresholds and triggers, and it was a concern that unfortunately the research kept coming off as too modest in terms of the rates of change or the impacts that were expected in terms of frequency or intensity of storms and rainfall patterns and droughts and such. So the science really moved ahead quickly and caught folks' attention. Some prominent disasters, storms, often longer droughts. We have some in the news today, when President Obama going to California to talk about this unprecedented drought in California. But other ones that, in some ways, less in this country, but really had a big impact outside. So heat waves in France that killed 40,000 people about a decade ago, or severe flooding, really brought those countries and those communities together in ways that kind of broke through some of the partisan political divide and brought greater momentum to tackling these issues, and that it was notably some of their foreign policy and security policy communities bringing this to the table, not just coming out of an environmental or scientific perspective. Some of those same countries then put it into the UN fora that take these things up. So the Security Council, for the first time ever, discussed an environmental issue. It was climate change twice in 2007 with the Brits putting it forward, and just a couple years ago with the Germans putting it forward. So the global institutions that we have focusing on security issues were picking it up as well. In the General Assembly, all the countries at the table did it as well, although very different source. It was the small island states that were suddenly looking at projections of sea level rise and said, you want to talk about security, this is an existential threat to our existence. So you better believe we think climate change is a security issue, and we want the rest of the world that largely is responsible for these challenges to take it up in those forums. And then finally, it became part of the broader environmental debate. And I should also add the wider, how do we frame our broader security agenda in a post-Cold War world where suddenly things are seemingly more complex without the organizing principles of superpower competition. So apologies if we have any atmospheric scientists or any natural or physical scientists associated with climate change here, because the next two slides are bound to offend you. I promise. This is the very quick snapshot version of what is a shorthand of bullet points of what is anticipated to be the impacts, and unfortunately what is already being observed in some cases as impacts of climate change. And so many of these will be familiar to you from the larger public discourse, and of course there are entire books and enormous assessments written on even pieces of each of these items. But certainly, in shorthand, the anticipated increased frequency and intensity, and that depends a little bit where you are as to where the balance of that is, but the extreme weather events, the flooding, the droughts, and what was lumped together in this kind of notion of extremes. And so, fortunately, you are familiar with these phenomena in this part of the world, but that these are going to be more of them, and they're going to be more intense. That associated and connected to that, we are seeing, for a variety of reasons, rising sea levels, in part if you think about water, when it warms, it expands, but also because there's particularly melting of ice, adding more water to the pot, and unfortunately also areas where the ground is subsiding. So it's not climate change, but it manifests or exacerbates this challenge of sea level rise, and that's coming and really important for our coastal areas. The change in disease patterns, the temperature change, because changes in where those diseases can survive and where those vectors can thrive. Loss of natural water towers. If you can picture a water tower that we'd have in the neighborhood as our water supply, for big parts of the world, those are glaciers or snow. Those are their water towers. And with the loss of those, it's essentially they're taking down that infrastructure that literally countries are dependent on, regions are dependent on. And so the implications of that are tremendous for those folks. And then some other areas that had been largely inaccessible because of ice, like in the Arctic, are becoming more and more accessible in ways that we'll see have real geopolitical implications. So those are kind of direct. So how do we then respond? Well, we respond by moving, the movement of people. And there are lots of reasons why it's great to move. It makes a lot of sense to move. But that can be done well, and it can be done in a challenging fashion. It certainly has impact on economic activity, all these changes. Some of it responding to the extremes and building back, others in terms of longer term, say, declines in economic productivity or connected to agricultural productivity. Impacted not just on droughts on terrestrial, on land, but what it means for marine ecosystems and fisheries and what the ecosystem that support that, again, translating into big economic impacts, food security and livelihood impacts. And then new opportunities in terms of access to resources that were inaccessible and transportation routes. We'll talk a little bit about the geopolitics of that. So that's a really, again, promised to offend all climate scientists in terms of that broad and very quick 30,000-foot view of shorthand for what we anticipate as climate changes. So in part, these things came together in 2007, and to kind of pull out and highlight one set of actors put this issue on a broader political agenda, and certainly with a security agenda. And so we had 14 American flag officers, retired, 3- and 4-star admirals and generals, came together not to debate the climate science, but to get the presentations of the current state of climate science and say, so if this is what we anticipate happening, what does it mean for the security community? They're brought together by a group called the CNA, the old Center for Naval Analysis in D.C., And this distinguished group of military officers found essentially they set the agenda for this discussion that we're now having, because they said what ships and planes and what platforms we need to procure, what kind of training, where we're going to operate, where we're not going to be able to operate, what we're going to be asked to do, what threats in a specific context of overt violence are we going to need to respond to, and what, in a larger context, what impacts these are going to have for the stability of the United States, friends and allies, other strategic countries around the world. These were issues that were going to come up. Their institution was an institutional last resort. They were going to be called in if all else failed. And so in part, they needed to understand that and put that into their thinking. But they also had a message for the folks who were tackling climate change in the civilian side, both public and private sector, that it was time for them to step up and tackle what they called the threat multiplier of climate change. So that threat multiplier then became a frame that has permeated then subsequent efforts. This is the Quadrennial Defense Review. Is every 4 years the Defense Department looks at what are the broad issues that are facing and how do they readjust doctrine and procurement and training to tackle them. In 2010, climate change and energy were front and center. That they were concerned about how these dynamics could worsen existing conflicts. So a lot of this was kind of a nuance that can be lost in some of the advocacy discussions. It's not that suddenly this climate change phenomenon is going to create a whole new set of conflicts, but it comes into this complex mix, as we'll see, where there's already a context of a fragile state. There's already a conflict. And this is something that, unfortunately, can be times where it's adding fuel to those fires. With the extreme weather events, well, how does that, yes, okay, we can have, and we'll see how it increases the need for maybe more humanitarian response that the security institutions may play. But also, when countries fail to respond to these kinds of crises, it actually undercuts the support for the governments themselves. And so if sitting at, say, at the Pentagon, you're interested in the stability and trying to assess the stability of different countries, you have to look and see if they're anticipating and experiencing some of these changes under climate change. How is the government going to be perceived if they're not seen as responding to this in adequate fashion by their people? And what does it mean for the support? And then finally, this notion of triggers and tipping points and thresholds that are certainly familiar in the natural world, that we also see playing in the social interactions around resources and politics, where climate change as this threat multiplier can play a negative role. So here's how it was summed up by the intelligence community, the National Intelligence Council, the ones who do the assessments that are, I should say, it's not just the intelligence community, but they consult all of government and then come up with their analysis. So they said climate change will aggravate existing problems such as poverty, social tensions, environmental degradation, ineffectual leadership, and weak political institutions that threaten state stability. So it's a good reminder that it's not an argument that climate change will beget conflict, but it is part then of this mix that really makes dealing with these other challenges all the more difficult. This was done in 2008 when there was a National Intelligence Council assessment of climate change and impacts for U.S. national security. So a couple examples. Yemen is one perhaps that's not on the front pages of the papers every day, but one that perhaps provides one of the most stark situations. It's literally a country where it is not hyperbole to talk about the country running out of water. Certainly the water they have is in many occasions not well managed. But when it becomes a real discussion about relocating your capital because you don't have water sources, this is a challenge that is has, as so many of these do, local dimensions, and then are piled on with these additional stressors. It's also an example that I highlight because it illustrates this notion of climate change is going to have impact for a lot of countries. But when you put it into the security realm, they start winnowing and narrowing that set of topics with countries that also pose challenges for other areas. And so from a traditional foreign policy in terms of terrorism and other groups that are operating, who we are, shall we say, opposing on the various battlefields. This is a place where those kinds of activities are going on, where we certainly have operations in our wider context of responding to terrorism and those who oppose us. And that makes this country one that is on a list that brings together these issues, where the climate and water, largely what it means for their water supply, is front and center in security considerations. One that does often occupy above the fold on the newspapers is the country of Pakistan. For a variety of reasons, this is a country that by all measures is of great interest for all the right reasons and all the wrong reasons. Certainly its critical position in South Asia and the history of animosity with India. Certainly the fact that it's now a country possessing nuclear weapons. Certainly because there are fundamental sources of instability inside the country now, and forces that, again, in that larger context that includes Afghanistan, but also goes beyond that, is going to be on anyone's list of a traditional security issue. But unfortunately, as this photo illustrates, and this map also gives greater detail, this is a country that's tremendously vulnerable to climate change and is experiencing, and those pictures were 2010, severe and becoming more severe flooding, with the dark blue being areas of severely affected by floods, and the lighter. So you can see running the whole course of the country. And so, okay, it's a flood and you clean up. Well, these are one areas where it's destroying crops for a season, where it's fundamentally undermining the food security and the livelihoods of literally millions of people who are already living on the margins, who are already participating in some of these movements that are ones that in our security realm are of great interest and unfortunately not in a positive light. And so as we look at the broader context of how climate change is going to affect fragile states that matter on a variety of areas, including particularly the security side, this is going to be an issue where that notion of a threat multiplier, unfortunately, is of grave concern to our security community. This was a case study that occupied much of the attention of a recent National Academy of Sciences study. So we have, often at the behest of other parts of government now, the State Department and the Defense Department asking the country's best scientists to come together and assess it. And this is one of the places that the chair of that panel really urges us to focus our attention. I was talking with one of your members here before. We were talking about food security. What's this mean? Well, we can talk about other fragile states, some of which may not be above the fold for like Pakistan, but still we're hearing a lot about, whether it's Mali or Niger, or southern Sudan, or Ethiopia. You can see that red band across sub-Saharan Africa. This is an area of grave concern around what it will mean for agricultural productivity. With the red being 50% or more decline in food productivity by 2080 because of changes in rainfall, essentially deeper drought, or when the rain comes, it comes altogether rather than the orange being 20 to 50%. So this is really, on cereals, really fundamental to food insecurity and underlying sources of livelihoods and the ability to feed your kid tomorrow, and what that plays into poverty questions and how we build capable states, functioning states in those areas, and where those populations can enjoy even the basic benefits of food security. This is going to be challenged in ways that, again, rise to the level of concern for folks outside of strictly a humanitarian context. Very different roles. There are a couple examples there with those fragile states, but on the conflict side, which is often a frame and a really important frame for what roles this may play, but I was reminded when talking about this by the major general who's on point for that National Intelligence Council. He's like, Jeff, you guys in the outside the military and intelligence think we're only interested in the violent conflict. We are, but we're interested in that broader lens too. But in that more narrow context of conflict that we can also focus on, we have, again, not a new conflict, right? From time immemorial, those who had livestock and herders, the pastoralists, have been coming in contact with the sedentary farmers who have their crops. The problem is now things are, the loss of arable land through desertification, the deep, longer and deeper droughts mean that these conflicts are happening faster, more severely in places like Sudan and southern Sudan, that is, again, putting it on a broader agenda that requires a conflict entrepreneur, right? It doesn't just happen. It's not a deterministic argument. You need that conflict entrepreneurial regime in Khartoum to play that negative role. But nevertheless, these are the conditions in which, if you're going to truly understand the challenges we're facing in this broader security environment, these issues have to be part of it. The farmers versus the farmers at the wellhead, sometimes it's too little water, sometimes it's too much water, which is seen as contradictory evidence when in fact both of these things can happen at the same time. And so we have research going both of those directions, so you're seeing upticks in violence. We talked about the sea levels pushing pokes across borders, and we'll talk a little bit about that in migration, disappearing water towers, and then one that fortunately, despite the fact that there are 276 rivers shared by two or more countries, history really shows countries haven't fought water wars between country and country. Local level, absolutely. The question is, that confidence is based on past experience. And so now we're increasingly having, including that National Intelligence Council assessment, people asking the question, will the future be like the past? Will our political institutions be able to navigate those upstream, downstream water issues when the water tower disappears, in terms of the glaciers, say, in Central Asia or in the Andean region in Peru? And that's one where it is, again, it's not certain, but from a security perspective, a precautionary perspective, that's part of the agenda that they're grappling with and feel the need to grapple with. So I mentioned migration. It couldn't be a climate and security talk without mentioning the country of Bangladesh, almost to the point of cliche, but unfortunately it is one where these issues really come together. It's, as you know, a low-lying country that is subject to severe storms and is literally losing its territory to rising seas. Many of those people are moving to the capital, to Dhaka, which is a challenged environment, let's say, to begin with. But some of them are moving across the border to India. Sometimes that works. Often they're met with the fence, and in some occasions, a kind of a shoot-on-site approach to immigration control, which I don't say lightly, but is one that is a kind of grave concern, not so much that it will be that challenge that Bangladesh will ever challenge India, but in terms of what impact that has, that lack of safety valve in terms of migration, what that will then have back in Bangladesh in terms of the impact for the stability of that country, and certainly the relations between those two critical countries. This I put up because on the migration scenario, we hear an awful lot about cities. And this is a list of the top 20 most vulnerable cities of a million or more. Some of them are down the street, literally. We could have easily a whole discussion about what all this means for the United States, and that's a really important discussion to have. We chose to focus on the international security realm. Of course, they're connected. But I do it in part because to show that while many of the examples I've used have been fragile states, there are some really capable states that are facing these issues too, but they have a different kind of vulnerability. It's not that they're not vulnerable, but it's that wealth and infrastructure of coastal cities that provides and creates a vulnerability and a set of challenges. And so whether it's Lagos in Nigeria or Shanghai, these are big issues in part because of where do people move, in part how is that done in an anticipatory fashion, or is that done in a reactive fashion? One that there's not a lot of there's not a lot of clarity as to what the impacts are. Folks just see this as going to be an important issue, and part of what the security community is doing now is funding studies to try to anticipate and find some analogs as to what is likely to happen with these scenarios. So we mentioned the Arctic. The Arctic in the context of the potential for climate change raising new issues of geopolitics that are, you know, often reduced to heartstring arguments about the polar bears. And, you know, I'm for the polar bears. I don't want to dismiss that as being not being an important topic. But what it's a larger sign of, as we lose the sea ice, but it's not just the coverage, but also the thickness, there are a whole variety of, it's a new ball game in so many ways. One, resources that were inaccessible, fossil fuel resources notably, but not limited to that were inaccessible because ice are now accessible. So there's the new race to extract those resources. Then those are multiple countries trying to do that. The really challenging environment in which that's in, and so like so many maritime crises, the military is asked to be the ones to bail folks out when there are problems. And so in that sense, it is both that opportunity of new resources, that changing transportation routes. And so you could say, well, that's a commercial issue, isn't it, Jeff? And in many respects, yes. But if you're cutting down 5,000 miles in a week of transportation time for Russian fossil fuels to make it to China, which is where they're going, and that picture there is China's first icebreaker, then that is, again, not that we're concerned about violent conflict in the Arctic, but we are really interested in strategic competition with other great powers. I would submit, as certainly the Navy in particular and the Coast Guard paying an awful lot of attention to what these changes mean for what they're expected to do in crisis response. So we thought it was difficult to plug a well in the warm water of the Gulf, right? And imagine that in the chilly water and the roiling seas of the Arctic. And as well as work out the maritime border disputes that it now raises, where folks weren't really caring before in many respects. Now suddenly when it's about resources becomes a much bigger issue in that broader foreign and security policy context. Humanitarian response. So we talked about this a little before, and the anticipated increased number and intensity. And this is a tough one in the sense that it's hard to say, you know, Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Sandy, or the typhoon that was in the Philippines, which is represented so vividly. It is both true and beside the point that you can't attribute a specific storm to climate change. If when we move beyond a weather forecast to climate, which is the longer term trends in these things, that we see the increased intensity and frequency being of grave concern, and where, because they have the capacity, and often the only ones who have the capacity, these institutions, these security institutions, are called upon to do it. And we want to do that, and we should do that from a purely humanitarian perspective, from a moral obligation to help address this tremendous suffering that comes. But if you look at these lists of regions, the Pakistans, the East Africa's, the Sahel, the Burma, which just had a tremendous typhoon just a couple years back, certainly Philippines, I would submit, and I think the security institutions are starting to see this as not just helping folks out when they're down, but that back to that, how countries recover and how they recover being critical to their stability and longer-term prospects, that finding ways to do that when you are starting to have multiples going on at the same time in these key countries becomes a strategic concern, not just a humanitarian one. And so some of the games in that sense of scenario planning, some of the gaming that's being done, and I know Admiral Pruer, who is part of that group of retired admirals and generals, their concerns were, well, if we're asked to do one of these big relief efforts, that's one thing. But what happens when two or three are going on at the same time? What is that? What does that mean for how we can respond? What does that mean for what other things we can't do and the capacities that we have? And so these are the challenges that come to the fore when discussing these issues. And then a kind of a final set of, I wish they were over the horizon, but they're largely issues to come and for us to go in with our eyes open, which is we kind of talked about direct impacts of climate, indirect impacts and how we respond and such and how they could pose security challenges. But I think, unfortunately, we need to add another category, and that category is around how we respond to these challenges themselves. So if we're getting serious about responding to climate change, how can those very responses to try to, you know, well-intentioned, do right by that issue, actually create some challenges, some problems that could even result in conflict? And we backdraft is a term that we at the Wilson Center in a series of essays trying to raise this issue with the foreign policy and security policy environmental community have called it. Picture there, Three Gorges Dam in China. Certainly hydropower is seen as one response as a non-carbon-based energy source. Biofuels sparking conflict. So a few years ago, the Europeans, they're taking climate change seriously. They decided to make targets on transportation with renewable energy. As a result, one of the key inputs for meeting that demand, palm oil, really accelerated, I think it doubled the price of it, accelerated the deforestation literally on the other side of the earth in terms of in Malaysia and Indonesia, causing local conflict around that kind of cut first, pay off the community later approach to land conversion that lead to these massive palm oil plantations as we see here. Another one that is, again, just emerging and we don't know so much about, in part because they don't have to tell us, are this notion of land grabs. And you may have seen a little bit of this conversation about land grabs. What does that mean? Well, if you are a wealthy country that is water poor or food poor, and you really are sure it's going to become even more so in the future, then suddenly it becomes very rational to start securing your water or your food in third countries. Essentially, food as virtual water, right? So you make up for not having water by buying or leasing land in other countries. Which, again, in principle, sounds like a trade in food, which, if it were that, might be okay. But they've lost faith in that international food market and said, you know, we're going to buy land in Ethiopia, say the Chinese, to ensure our food security. The problem is they don't have to tell us the terms. They don't particularly tell their communities, the affected communities whose land's been sold to the other country, about those conditions. And so how that plays into losing land, often losing the benefits in terms of the social stability. We have at least anecdotal evidence that, for example, the coup in Madagascar, a South Korean proposed rice deal for, I think, a third of the total land area, was a big part of what first brought people into the streets. Then it became about a bunch of other issues, but directly part of the coup that overthrew the government. And so these are things that are just emerging as a response to these challenges posed by climate and water and food scarcity that we need to move forward. Finally, on nuclear power, there are obviously a lot of debate about the advantages and disadvantages. One advantage is that it does not contribute to greenhouse gases and so has an appeal from a climate perspective. But as we increase that, then it's obviously a traditional security concern to be worried about increased accessibility, increased use of nuclear waste. Often it's not actually for bombs. It's just the prospect for making poor use of nuclear waste as a weapon. It turns out the green economy is still an economy that is critical for having inputs from the mining sector. So say we're making this transition to addressing climate change, there's still going to be critical minerals. And so we're asking, what is the new list of strategic minerals in a green economy? And there are a number of places where some of those are heavily found, concentrated in some countries. So are those countries going to have and experience the same petro state dysfunction often that those countries around fossil fuels, so the Nigerias and the Angolas and the Sudans, are we going to have that dynamic around some of these other countries? And certainly, this is an issue where many of these inputs are also important for the military as well as the green economy that we're asking questions about coming forward. And then finally, in part because some of these issues are just so hard to deal with, right? Number of people have said, well, you know, climate politics, they do a lot of talking, but there's not a lot of action. And it's really difficult, there's no doubt, to make fundamental changes around reducing our carbon footprint, mitigating against climate change. And so if you haven't heard the term geoengineering, I will submit to you that you probably will more in the future. It's an umbrella term for these kind of almost fantastic plans to either reflect more heat out, kind of prevent it from coming into the Earth's atmosphere, or to find ways to store carbon in new ways that would reduce the impact of carbon as a greenhouse gas. And so whether that is putting big mirrors in space to reflect that radiation from the sun back out and keep it from coming into the atmosphere, whether that is, and this is the most common scenario, of essentially simulating the effect of a volcano that would put lots of particulates in the upper atmosphere and again reflect out sunlight, but doing that by either blasting with artillery or doing it with airplanes, putting lots of sulfates in the upper atmosphere, or seeding the oceans with iron so that the oceans will absorb more CO2. These are the technological fixes that are imagined as ways to get-out-of-jail-free card, essentially, in tackling the carbon and climate problems. They are a set of issues that literally when the Defense Department in 2010 was preparing that report, that quadrennial review, this apparently was the most popular question and topic that people wanted to talk about. Some because they wanted the military to deploy these technologies, and others because they wanted the military to stop people from deploying these technologies. Either way, it is going to be one that we hear a lot about, particularly as our other efforts fail. And unfortunately, it's an area that has no international law, let alone or norms, let alone laws to regulate that behavior. We've kind of not talked about it like it was a dirty secret, hoping it would go away. But unfortunately, that space will be filled as the challenges move forward. So finally, I think we have a set of issues and a set of topics and set of actors that require us to talk, collaborate, work together, but we continue to organize ourselves in silos. The stovepipe, the silo, the metaphor for working in our one issue area, whether that's a government department, a academic institution with its different departments, or an environmental or a non-governmental organization that kind of splits up the world into their own specific issues. We set up all sorts of barriers for working together. But I hope that some of these examples have shown you the ways in which what seem like two very different topics. And when I got into this early on a couple decades ago, people would give me these quizzical looks and talk about environment and security. But we need to find ways to literally break out of the silos and find ways to collaborate and understand that these issues that we may associate with the naive tree hugger trying to hug that tree really is a set of topics where those folks in the security community both have reason to be concerned, but also have some tools that can help us think through our responses and understand that as we deal with the impacts of these complex challenges, they're going to be ones that can't be pigeonholed in a single sector. It can't just be the environment office that deals with them. They're going to present challenges to us across the board. And the sooner we break out of these silos and start working together to address them, the better we will be. So thank you very much for
Okay, I see a lady at the microphone. Thank you. You're up.
Thanks. I'm Linda Kimball, and it's great to see you, Jeff. And I want you to comment on what you think about work going on at places like Santa Fe to get us to accommodate multidisciplinary solutions to problems like climate change.
Melinda Kimball is someone who has been at the boardroom table, at the negotiating table on these issues for the U.S. government, and really has been one of the key leaders in the last couple decades in both trying to take all this in and process this and make it happen in the diplomatic world and now with her leadership at the UN Foundation. So, Melinda, it's wonderful to see you. You should be up here giving this talk. I think efforts like what's going on at Santa Fe Institute, places that really are explicitly designed to break down bounds, say that these are interdisciplinary topics in terms of the kind of academic traditions that come to the table, the broad set of tools that are used to analyze it, and having it be a very applied conversation. It's not an ivory tower conversation disconnected from how we're going to tackle them, but really meant to put these things together to try to formulate ways forward are exactly examples of what needs to have happen. It's unfortunately doesn't often translate into easy congressional earmarks or easy budget items or easy measures of success. I was asked today about how do we define success? How do we know when we're achieving success? And I gave probably a fairly unsatisfactory answer to say that we have to look at multiple levels and we have to look across these different issues. But a common denominator would be knowing that in some ways embracing that uncertainty, embracing the notion that we're going to experience greater variability and fluctuation, and start, whether it's our political institutions, our economic institutions, or our built environment and infrastructure, build in and adopt a fundamental notion of flexibility, resilience, that sees as the norm that variability, rather than assuming a status quo. We've had this much water in the past, we'll have this much water in the future. If you're a local city manager or you're the governor, if you're Governor Brown in California, those assumptions are gone. And the ways that we can better analyze these problems and design our solutions to take into account these linkages, the sooner we do that, the better we will be in terms of trying to foster the resilient institutions that we need to tackle these problems.
Given the fact that people need food and people need water and people cause pollution, which is very, very much a people problem. What are we doing internationally with our government for birth control?
Uh-huh. That's a very good question. It's often one that is kept in two different boxes, or if it's brought together, it is often framed as an us versus them. And so I tell my students the shorthand for understanding all international negotiations on these kind of global issues in the past have been we in the North saying there are too many people in the global South, your population is growing too quickly, and the global South saying there may not be as many of you, but boy, you are consuming so fast. So wealth versus poverty, the pollution of poverty and the pollution of wealth. Unfortunately, I think that actually misses the point because, of course, both present challenges that we have to grapple with. And that instead of the response being one that is seen as a kind of macro negative, a negative frame, can be actually the story of empowerment. And that's empowerment on the population side, and it's empowerment on the climate side. We talk too little about adaptation as responding to climate change by increasing that resilience, in some ways just increasing choices for people to adapt to these changes. And on the family planning side, we focus too much on targets and macro numbers, instead saying we're going to empower women and families to choose the number and the timing and spacing of the children they have. And by doing that with a voluntary provision of services, which our government literally is one of the world leaders in doing that, that empowerment of women, particularly women and girls, has all sorts of benefits in terms of their education, in terms of their autonomy and decision-making in the household, in terms of their health, and in connects to so many of these resources, because in big parts of the world, fetching the water is the women and girls' work, fetching the firewood is the women and girls' work, tending the fields is the women and girls' work. So it makes you wonder what the men are doing. But nevertheless, in all seriousness, they're watching the cattle and, you know, kind of whacking them once in a while. That this is a way for us to have a conversation, and again, this would be an example, thinking outside the box as to what tools we can bring to bear. So if our job is, in many respects, to lower the vulnerability of these populations, then thinking into these areas that are traditionally seen as separate are ways that we can help lower the vulnerability, in this case, of the population that is least responsible for causing climate change, but most vulnerable. So the sub-Saharan African woman, the inability to make those decisions about the size of their family and the spacing of their children is one place where we can make progress as well, with a positive agenda rather than a thou shalt not agenda.
Having seen what a failed state can do to U.S. security, I want to ask you a question about whether your security conference had looked at that in terms of impact on U.S. security. And an example is northern Mali. We may look at that and say the cause was terrorists, separatists, but having lived in West Africa in the 70s, when there were severe food problems, and seeing then the kinds of conflicts that you were talking about between herders and farmers, herders moving off land because it's not capable of growing or feeding their animals. I think that there may be a tremendous amount of things happening which then provide a basis for the terrorists to come in. And so the question is, did you identify certain failed states that might in the future, because of climate change, such as what happened in the Sahel in those years, whether those states are now potential enemies or bases for enemies of the U.S.?
Thank you for your question. It is one where your question goes to exactly the approach that we're suggested is needed for a conversation of assessing the long-term prospects for countries. And in that way, it's a modest argument, really. It's not to say you folks in the security community have missed it all and you need to stop paying attention to what you paid attention to before and look at these other issues that we're on about, land and food and water and the kind of climate stress that's coming. It's that those issues are going to be resonant and connected to your traditional security issues in ways that are diffuse, complex, not immediately apparent. They may be proximate or immediate in terms of the conflict, or they may be underlying. But nevertheless, you have to include it as part of the discussion if you're going to do anything more than just a Band-Aid approach of treating the kind of worst expressions of the failure to deal with that. And so in that way, it's a plea to open the conversation to this wider. And increasingly, that's being heard. There are lots of challenges to translate that into lists where you can go to prediction. And certainly, the government and other governments have tried to do that. A lot of time and effort spent on putting together a list that we could sit down and probably come fairly close to doing that. There's some more sophisticated efforts to get down to more local levels, because the national level data is most accessible, but not at a level of granularity that you really need, because as you pointed out, it's in the northern part of the country and the dynamics there are different in the south. So this is part of the challenge. But I think through various efforts that have made progress on this, some of those variables are now part of the conversation in determining those lists and where we prioritize and anticipate the countries facing some of these challenges, and also so that we can take the generals and the admirals' advice, right, and say if it gets onto their desk and the tools that the military has to respond, then we failed earlier. So they're the tool of last resort. They're the most expensive, and they're not necessarily at all well matched with meeting those livelihood needs around food security, other than being able to perhaps transport in relief. Their message was in part to others that they needed to get more serious about their efforts, and again, reflecting the basic assumptions of your question. So thank you for that.
Over here, please.
Could you talk specifically about food and food production and quality of food and how all this affects food, first in the United States?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're going to quickly take me outside of the area of expertise, which in Washington, that usually is no impediment to people talking, right? It's I'm ready to go on TV. What's the topic, right? I try to avoid falling prey to that. I think as the Africa example illustrates, there are very high stakes for food production that are often associated with changing temperatures and changing rainfall, not just totals, but when it comes, and does it come all at once or is it spread out? So there's a lot of anxiety, for example, around whether the monsoon rains that are timed in South Asia, whether those will change fundamentally in ways that really undercut the food productivity in that part of the world. There are lots of concerns that the impact of these droughts will be that we draw more on groundwater at an unsustainable rate, and that at some juncture that's going to reach some points where it's just not an option. It's not another get out of jail free. And that's going on in Beijing, that's going on in northern India, that's going on in the middle of this country in the Ogallala Aquifer, in terms of as much as some of our agriculture is irrigated in that fashion, though it's certainly not all of it. So it's a species dependent. Which crops are you growing? And you can get into the GM debate, and then you can genetically modified organisms debate, which is another talk about another politicized one. I think also complexities as well. So where we are now is not where we're going to be, right? With the rise of China and India, the rise of the middle class in these other countries, a huge impact for water and food is going to be the fact that they're going to want to eat meat on the regularity that we do. And that's incredibly more consumptive of water. And then you're growing other grains to feed that cattle, pork, and such. And so that has huge implications for food projections, who's growing what, where. And, are humans consuming it directly or is it feed? All of this comes together. So we need to, what is the expression in hockey? We need to look, shoot the puck where the person's going to be, not where they're standing now. And that just adds a degree of complexity that makes it all that much harder. So that was my Olympics reference there, my Sochi Olympics reference. Thank you, sir, for the question.
Thank you.